This is August 6th, and this is at Freiburg, and this is our first lecture on this morning, and I'm Dorothea Harvey, and my title this morning is Walking in the Land. My main field of study has been the Old Testament in the Bible, but my teaching has been all over. My teaching was in small colleges, so I found myself teaching all kinds of courses in religion and philosophy, in odd necessities like basic writing or remedial writing and things like that, reading and speaking, as well as mythology, women's studies, religious themes in literature. And I've learned a lot from teaching people all these things. You know, teaching is a wonderful way of learning. But there's one thing that I knew that I wanted very early in my teaching, and that was to live through the seasons in the land where the human writers of the Bible lived. I wanted to know what they were talking about when they wrote. I wanted to feel what they were looking at. I wanted to see what they were looking at, to know what the words meant when they used those words. And so I went for a year of archaeology in Jerusalem, and it was at that time I was in the part of Jerusalem that was in Jordan at that time. The line was just right beside the old city of Jerusalem then. And the school was just out north of the old city there. So, I was pleased when I heard about the topic for this session of the land of the Bible and the meaning of the land, what that would actually be meaning. There's one thing about that land, of course. It's located right on the crossroads between big empires of the ancient world. So that meant trade, and that meant conquests that kept happening. And when we were at the school, we took trips to neighboring Egypt, to Syria, to Turkey, and beyond. But when we stayed put and we excavated, then we were living in the land. And one thing that was very obvious very soon, everywhere we went was either up a mountain or down a mountain, either up a hill or down a hill. This is simply the way it was. And I'm glad other people have talked about the meaning of the hills and valleys of the land. Every walk was both up and down. I rode a mule to a wedding one day. We were out in the country there. And the first time the mule put its whole front end down suddenly to go down over a gully to come back up again, I nearly slid off the mule and just barely saved myself on. But every walk was a matter of either going up or going down. And then I realized that plea in the Psalms that God grant us a level path was not only for not too much climbing up or climbing down, but also when the path was around the side of a hill, so that you were walking on a path that kept sloping off, that the path would be wide enough that I wouldn't slide off sideways instead of staying on it. Every path in life has ups and downs, but it's a very important thing to be able not to slide off the path, and that was one thing that I think it means when it asks that we be on a level path, that we can keep our footing on that path. Mules and donkeys seem to be much better at that than I was. This is a hard thing sometimes to get up and down. But hills and valleys are important aspects of the land. But it was equally important to me to live through the seasons of the year in that land. The difference between dry and wet is equally important in that land. On one site, we lived in tents in a small valley, the Wadi Sir, which ran down to the Jordan Valley, the Jordan Wadi. Of course, Wadi just means valley. And our tents were quite near the tents of the local sheikh and his people. So in the morning, voices carry with no walls, and we could hear the morning prayers from the other tents, and the waking up, and the calls to the children and the goats. But the one word that we heard more than any other as discussions went on with the sheikh was "my water." That was what everybody came to discuss with the sheikh. Whose turn was it to let the irrigation water, the water from the irrigation ditch from upstream, flow into his field of corn, and for how long on this day? There was never any argument about whose turn it was to climb down into the wadi where we were to carry back a can of water for the day. Everybody knew that was for the women to do, and that's what they did. But the water, that was absolutely the crucial thing. And when I came home from that year of study there, and I saw people walking around my neighborhood, putting the hose out and spraying the lawn with water, just to make that lawn look pretty and as nice as their neighbors, and not to grow something, to make food come. It seemed awful. It was like a desecration, something which just simply, you don't do that with water. You don't do that. That was that important. That was simply awful. When Israel came into the land, the Jordan Valley, with its rivers, was part of that life-giving, fertile crescent. There were areas of real Arabian desert in the Near East, and there were fertile oases, but Israel did not come out of a totally dry desert to an oasis where you could pick fruits in all seasons. The coastal plain and the hill country had their rainy season and their dry season, and these varied from year to year. And when the rains finally came after a totally dry season, that meant the life is coming into the country again. The desert or the wilderness and the fruitful land were not experienced as separate territories of the earth. They were more like two aspects of the one overall climate of the land. And that seemed to me to fit beautifully with Swedenborg's sense of the correspondences of the two. These are not simply two separate areas. These are two sides of what my life is. And that's, I think, the way he deals with the correspondences. And that's why I was very much concerned with the dryness and the water and the reactions to these. Israel was between two empires, of course, in the ancient world, Egypt and Babylonia. And each one of those empires had its own continuing major river, a continuing source of water and of life. But neither empire was the setting for our Judeo-Christian religious faith. Ours came from that unpredictable area of sometimes drought and sometimes plenty, as Israel related to God and kept her faith or protested to God in all the different circumstances of life and survival in the land. That makes a real difference to me, I think. This is not one of those, the Nile, the Tigris, Euphrates, they were there. The water was there. For Israel, sometimes it was there and sometimes it was not. And I remember, and you couldn't tell just when the rainy season would come, when it would start. And I remember one time around Christmas time, sensing to myself, what our Christmas hymn, Joy to the World, is really speaking about. And of course it goes back, I mean, the word come from two of the Psalms in the Old Testament, that joy to the world, the Lord has come, let earth receive her King, let all rejoice. And there are two Psalms which have those words right in them. In Psalm 98, make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Break forth into joyous song and sing praises. With trumpets sound to the horn, make a joyful noise before the King, the Lord. Let the sea roar and all that fills it, the world and those who dwell in it. Let the floods clap their hands. Let the hills sing for joy together before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with equity. And Psalm 96 has most of those same words in it. The Lord reigns, let the heavens be glad, let the earth rejoice, let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the wood sing for joy before the Lord, before he comes. For he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with his truth. And every time before I was singing Joy to the World and noticing that all these, the references to nature in it, the trees, let everything rejoice before the Lord. And that's part of these psalms, this Psalm 98, Psalm 96, the basis for joy to the world, that all the ends of the earth. And then, how do we know the Lord has come? He has done it. His right hand has gotten him the victory. He's made known his victory. So make a joyful noise. All the ends of the earth have seen the victory of our God. So rejoice. And it came over me. I think the time of the writing of that psalm, of those psalms, what they're celebrating is the return of the rain. We have seen the presence of God, that gift of life coming back to the earth. The rains have come again and everybody can see it. And the life is coming back again into the world. And this is the Lord's doing. And this is what we thank God for. And we now have seen that. And we can see that. So let the field exult and everything in the field. And let's sing for joy. Because now we know that the Lord is with us, that the life has come again, that God is with us again for joy. I think that was Israel's sense of living in that land. As you come from a time of a holy dry season and you don't know when the rain is going to come again, you don't know if there's going to be enough to make you have a life-giving harvest. Then to see finally that rain coming. You remember Elijah on the top of Mount Carmel looking out to see if there was a cloud could be seen in the sky and to speak about the rain coming, the water coming. And that sense is in these psalms, and I think that that's what's carried over in our Christmas hymn, Joy to the World, the Lord has come. And for ancient Israel, to know that in the gift of life-giving water coming again to the earth. That theme comes, of course, in many places in the Old Testament. And in Hosea, the prophecy of Hosea, in chapter 6, the treatment there of Israel having gone off to other gods and then coming back again, and then Hosea calling to them to return and then saying what they would say back to God, "Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn that he may heal us. He has stricken and he will bind us up. After 2 days he will revive us, and on the third day he will raise us up that we may live before him. Let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going forth is as sure as the dawn. He will come to us as the showers, as the spring rains that water the earth." And God speaking then in the poem to Israel, "What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your love is like a morning cloud, like dew that goes early away. Therefore, I have hewn them by the prophets. I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Symbol for that, not a shower that promises rain and then doesn't give it, but a love that is there constant. The rain, the real spring rain that really comes, spring rains that water the earth, that make life come, growing again out of the earth." That is one of the basic symbols throughout the Old Testament. And one of the beautiful ones, and ones you really learn to live with as you live out there. Water's heavy, you know, when you carry it, when you have to get it coming in, and to have it just be there, it is an amazing kind of an experience. Take Isaiah 35. "The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The majesty of Carmel and Sharon, they shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of one of our God. Strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. The eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped. The tongue of the dumb shall sing for joy, for waters shall break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool, the thirsty ground springs of water." That is simply part of life in that part of the world. Irrigation means a real watering of the earth to make things grow. And water has a basic correspondence, of course, with truth and life. But real truth is always related to love and the good for Swedenborg. And he speaks here of wilderness as an absence of good because of the lack of truth, or as a longing for truth as a means to the good. That symbolism keeps coming up again and again, and the power, the presence of the water, and then the life-giving, not just a little flimsy bit of cloud or rain, but real irrigation-giving, life-giving water that comes to the earth. In Psalm 107, there's the description of people wandering around in the wilderness, some wandered in desert wastes, finding no way to a city to dwell in, hungry and thirsty. They cried to the Lord in their trouble. He delivered them from their distress. He led them by a straight way till they reached a city to dwell in. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love. He turns rivers into a desert. He turns the desert into pools of water, a parched land into springs of water. And there he lets the hungry dwell, and they can establish a city to dwell in. They sow fields and plant vineyards and get a fruitful yield. By his blessing they multiply greatly, and he does not let their cattle decrease. That presence of God, the hungry who can be ready to plant and sow fields, the presence of God caring for people is simply there with all of these different parts of the Bible, the Old Testament. And it comes in the New Testament also, in Revelation, in chapter 19, that wonderful image there, the 24 elders and the four living creatures fell down and worshiped God, who is seated on the throne, saying, Amen, Hallelujah. And from the throne came a voice crying, Praise our God, all you his servants who fear him, small and great. Then I heard what seemed to be the voice of the great multitude, like the sound of many waters, like the sound of mighty thunder peals, crying, Hallelujah, for the Lord our God the Almighty reigns. Let us rejoice and exult and give him the glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. There's an amazing power to me in the imagery of that passage there. And Swedenborg talks about about the symbolism there. He talks about the plant, the use of the plant, and he talks about the feeling there. In Apocalypse Explained, he says, in a word, from the soil in the heavens, nothing but use blooms forth. For use is the plant soul. The soul of the plant is the use of it. Because use is the plant soul, in those places in the spiritual world that are called deserts, where those are who in the world rejected works of charity, which are essential uses, no grass or herb of any kind is seen, but mere gravel and sand. But every good in act that is from the Lord through love to him and love toward the neighbor is meant by uses that blossom forth in the heavens. Every plant there represents a form of use, and whatever appears in it, from its first to its last, from its last to its first, from seed to flower, from flower to seed, exhibits the progression or extension from end to end of an affection and of its use, of love and its use. And those that are skilled in the sciences of botany, chemistry, medicine, and pharmacy come after death into a knowledge of spiritual uses from the plants in the spiritual world, and cultivate that knowledge and find the greatest delight in it. I've talked with such and have heard from them wonderful things." Isn't that a fun passage? And you think of Swedenborg's fascination with science and the physical sciences, and really having that sense of the power that comes with every good, every plant, a form of use, from the beginning to the end, from seed to flower, from flower to seed, and the wonder of the way that moves and the way that's part of God's providence. It's an amazing thing. From living there, it seemed to me that that's one thing that just had to happen to the people of Israel. Living between two empires meant there were invasions, there was trade, but just living in the land itself with the unpredictable, you couldn't tell about the end of the dry season, when that would come. You couldn't tell when the rain would come that would mean it would not be a drought, we would be able to survive, there would be plenty for the year to come. I think that that was to be immediately conscious of the providence of God. And our faith did not come from Egypt or from Babylonia. It did not come from those two places that had their reliable source of water. Of course, the Mesopotamian Valley had floods. That was not totally reliable, but still, it had water, and that came regularly and was there. And I think that what Swedenborg is conscious of here, and what is simply a reality, is that as the people who heard the word of God there in the land, were people who lived in that sense of providential relationship with God. It was not something they could know. It was something they had to trust, and they had to be immediately conscious of the providence of God, living in that land of such extremes of dryness and rain and enough water to survive. And it's in that land that our faith came into existence. And I think that sense of God's providence is just one thing that is there in all of the teachings of our church and in the teachings of the Bible, that this is part of what it meant to people to live there in that land. And so I think the meaning of the land is extremely important for us as a church and for us as Christians, as for us as part of our faith in the world today. So I think the land is important. Okay? Are there questions? Please.
You talked about how much they look forward to the coming of the rain.
Is it working now?
Yes.
Okay. You talked about the anxiousness with which they waited the coming of the rains, and I was wondering to what degree the coming of the rains also was accompanied by an element of danger, the floods and that sort of thing.
Was accompanied by what?
The danger of flood, of too much of a good thing.
I don't think so, no. No, it's true that there, when it's totally dry and you get a downpour, then you can get a flash flood. That's true. And I was surprised at that because, you know, to look at the dryness and then expect rain to come, you think, oh, but it's true, you can get flash floods, and that did happen. And yet, there was no severe, I mean, there was no flood that wiped everything out. Couldn't be, because the land is up and down, and it just flows down in the valley or wherever it goes. And of course, when you get a flash flood that comes at an opportune moment, like the one where it wiped out the Philistine army there. Now, that was absolutely amazing at Mount Carmel and the Megiddo, where the enemy, the Egyptians who had chariots, were in that. And then this flash flood came, and they were absolutely caught in the mud, and they couldn't move. Whereas Israelites on their 2 feet could move through. And here, God was doing this, and God was right there. So yes, but I don't know of any permanently dangerous flood the way you had in the Mesopotamian area. You don't get that kind of flood, no. You get a flash flood and sudden repercussions, but it's a different, it's not that kind of complete wiping out of life that you get in Mesopotamia. That was just awful.
Any comments about the correspondence of the flash flood?
I didn't check it out. I didn't look up on that, on the correspondences, but I'd have to just feel into it. I don't... I'm not even sure if Swedenborg was conscious of flash flood as a reality. I don't know whether Sweden has those, does it? But they come in desert country sometimes, yes. I'd have to check that out. I will look it up.
That occurs to me on that is when you've been sort of tooling along and everything's fine, and all of a sudden you learn something that is overwhelming and sort of sweeps you away. Something has happened, or you find out something that is just too much for you at that moment. You lose your bearings, get swept away, but it doesn't last long, perhaps. Then you get your bearings again.
Yeah, yeah.
And you begin to recover.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A flash flood is not the flood. It's another kind of an experience, yeah. Yes, right. And of course, on the Mediterranean side of the mountains, you get more rain. Now, I was on the Jordanian side of the mountains at that time, and that's where you get much less continuing, much not trustworthy rain at all. And so this precarious living there on that side is just an amazing thing. Yes, right.
The west-facing slopes get the rain, the east-facing slopes are much drier.
Yes, right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Could everyone please keep the mic closer to their mouth than George was?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to talk that with
you. Was there any down there before?
I've read in Swedenborg that the reason, the more or less the reason why the rivers and valleys and hills in that land had those meanings is that the very earliest people who lived there believed in symbolism and correspondence, and they, it sounds like almost like they assigned those meanings to them. What I'm wondering is whether that could have happened anywhere. You seem to be indicating that there was something special about the Holy Land itself that actually lent itself to that. Could it? Could these things have developed somewhere else on Earth, or do you think that is a unique place where it was just bound to develop there?
Well, I think that obviously that sense comes with many other parts of the world. Like you think of American Indians and all different parts of the world. But it's simply a fact of life, I think, that where you got your two empires, they had a stable source of water that they survived. And the issue there was not survival. The issue there was organization and government and all of that. Laws coming into existence very early in Mesopotamia. But that the unpredictable part of farming in a land where you get your dry season and your rainy season and you simply, you don't know the times of it, I think that is what leads to a real sense of providence, of providence of God, relationship with God, where we have to keep wondering, questioning, asking, demanding, speaking our anger, thanking God for life when it can survive, going to Egypt if there's too much drought and we have to really just abandon the whole thing. So the Nile Valley and the Tigris-Euphrates Valley didn't have those problems. And I think that that kind of issue of asking all of us to be constantly aware that life itself is in our relationship with the giver of the rain and the giver of the land. I think that was part of the biblical faith. But sure, there are plenty of other parts of the world which have a similar sense of what farming means. I think Kansas in this country has a very similar sense of the ups and downs and the what it takes to really patiently go ahead year after year and trust that there will be a life-giving harvest. And I think, yeah, that's simply part of the biblical faith, yes. And it's not so much, well, yeah, being invaded and all of that, that was very important, and the prophet spoke to that, of course. But for daily living, to live in that kind of a climate, I think was part of the sense of what? Of being in constant connection with the presence of God. That was simply part of life in that area.
And do you have any thoughts on the differences in the religion of Canaan, or at least of the Israelites, and that of those other areas? I'm particularly wondering whether that would have any influence on monotheism versus polytheism, or whether that would come from a whole different source.
Boy, that's a tough one. I don't know. You think of the symbolism of Baal and Asherah for the Canaanite tradition, which of course is polytheistic, and the tension there between the two, and Baal the fighter and Asherah the growing, and the two different, and for them they attack each other, and for Israel to come to that sense of one God present that led to the biblical sense of God's, of one God and providence over the whole thing, and not a warfare between the two. I'd have to think about that one. I'm not sure about that. Of course, the other nations, their mythology went back to that sense of warfare with the ocean and the abyss, Tiamat, the warrior, as the source of the salt water. And then there, the division between salt and fresh water was absolutely crucial. And that was part of the Mesopotamian culture. Whereas salt water was simply what? Another reality for Israel. They didn't relate to the sea, the salt water, in the same way at all. For them, it was living in the land of the rivers and the land there. And yet, as I say, Canaan had this real warfare type. I'd have to think about that one hard. I'm not sure. I know that sense of having to trust the providence to survive in those hills. I mean, that's tough. That's a hard one. And just driving by and, you know, driving down the road from Jerusalem down into the valley and seeing little children come out and offer you eggs for sale, you know, where there's no sign of life whatever, but they're coming out of something there and saying, hey, buy eggs. I don't know how people live in that. It's just, I have to feel on that one. I don't know, but it's amazing.
I guess I don't know the topography of the Holy Land as well as I probably should. And, you know, I was wondering if you could elaborate on, you were saying everywhere you were was up and down hills, extremely hilly.
Yeah, except Jordan Valley, of course, you could go, and that's where people could travel. Yeah, right.
And just wondered if you could just point out on the map there and show me which areas are, like, really up and down in hills and where it's valleys and...
Okay.
Whether it's all of the Holy Land that's really hilly, because it might give me a different...
Okay. Here's the valley. Here's the Jordan River. Here's the valley right here. And between the ocean and the valley is mountains. So this whole thing is up and down and up. And then as you come up here, you're up again into mountains. And then up and down. So this is your valley. And then there are valleys that go down into the Jordan Valley. Yeah. But here's your mountain here on Mount Carmel. And so then you get a valley right beside that goes right down. So you get valleys and farming right close here. And of course here, your valley right down. But here, the big valley. And then Jericho, of course, is way down. And here it's totally dry, except as you get the water coming down the river. But and then you right out into really desert kind of dryness as you get out. But here's your valley and your flatland and your growth. And here's your valley right here. And then up and down and up and down and up and down, but then coming up. Like from Jerusalem to Jericho is just right, it's mountain road right straight down, and windy mountain road.
I appreciated your comment that you wanted to live there a whole year.
Yeah.
Because I've seen those tours, you know, try to get to the Holy Land, put together a tour, and be there for a week or something. So,
yeah.
And I read a little bit about geography to try to prepare for this, but I didn't get a sense, and there was a question that came up yesterday that I didn't have a real answer for, but John was baptizing Jerusalem and the areas of Judea. The question had to do with the Mediterranean side of the Dead Sea, that area down below Jerusalem,
yeah,
toward the bottom of the sea.
Yeah.
What that was like, was that a jungle? Was that wilderness? There aren't much, right along the Dead Sea, south of Jerusalem.
Right down.
Do you have a sense for what that area is like?
Well, right now, that's just very, very dry, right in here. Very dry. Like the Dead Sea Scrolls, and where you wander around finding that territory, it's caves in mountain peaks and so on, and rough caves and all rock and all sand. This is all...
That's why there's nothing there. There's no civilization. You wouldn't particularly live there.
No. The people living out in the desert and praying to God for the end of the age, you know, waiting for the final judgment and the final warfare, they were out there.
That's for them, huh?
Yeah, right. But that's not... The farming areas are up north up here, like up here in the valley and all. There you get real farming going on, which is fun. Well, we're running out of time, so I think we better quit, hadn't we?